support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
And young girls, they do get weary, weary.
Back in the 1960s, Stax Records served as the incubator of the Memphis, Tennessee soul music genre. This is where musicians like Otis Redding, Isaac Hayes, Albert King, Rufus and Carla Thomas, and Booker T and the MGs came to cut their records. Over a 16-year period, Stax Records placed 167 hit songs in the top 100 on the pop charts and 243 hits in the top 100 rhythm and blues charts. Come along and join Tim Sampson, Communications Director for the Soulsville Foundation, where he talks about the Stax Museum of American Soul Music, the genesis of the term Soulsville, the astounding Stax Music Academy, and Soulsville Charter School.
Right now we are in the Stax Museum at the original site of Stax Records. We're in the Hall of Records, where there's about 800 singles on the walls and 300 albums. This is what I call the art gallery, because this is when they really put a lot of work into the album design. So you're seeing albums by artists like Otis Redding, Booker T and the MGs, Isaac Hayes, Johnny Taylor, the Staple Singers, the Marquis, Little Milton, Rufus and Carla Thomas. Those are a lot of the people who recorded at Stax Records and made it the international influential label that it became.
Stax Records has been a part of our collective Americana history for a long time.
Yeah.
But augering down a dimension that I did not understand until I got here to Memphis has to do with Soulsville. That's an incredible story. Stax Records is intimately intertwined and connected with our collective history, you know, as Americana idiom. One dimension that I knew nothing about and did not understand until I got to Memphis had to do with the Soulsville connection.
We are in Soulsville, the neighborhood known as Soulsville,
yes,
USA.
Which is literal and true. Tell us that story.
It is. Well, it got its name because Detroit, Motown, their nickname was Hitsville. And when Al Bell came to Memphis in 65, he renamed this Soulsville. Then it kind of grew, and the whole neighborhood became known as Soulsville, USA. And you have all these artists who were born here or grew up here or recorded here. Aretha Franklin was born about 5 minutes from where we're standing. Maurice White, who founded Earth, Wind & Fire, grew up two blocks away. Memphis Slim, Memphis Mini. If you go two or three blocks in this direction, you're going to find Royal Studio, which was High Records, which was where Al Green recorded all of his music. And this is a relatively small area.
You're talking about a few blocks in one direction and another.
Yeah, you walk past Booker T. Jones' former home, and you go around the corner, and you're at Aretha Franklin's former home's front yard. So there was just this neighborhood was filled with music and musicians, and there was a couple of nearby high schools that had, you know, back in the day, these great band directors, and tons of churches where the kids grew up singing in the choir and playing in the band. And it's just sort of just this melting pot, and it's still kind of that way today.
But that whole dynamic, that whole passion for music within these neighborhoods predates Stax.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, in Memphis, you had music forever, you know, Beale Street, starting back in the 20s and 30s, and then you had all the big bands and the jazz and the blues and gospel music, and it's just one of those cities where the timing was right, the timing was weird. It's, you know, it's on the Mississippi River. A lot of people migrated here from the South, you know, when they were freed as slaves. And Memphis has always been sort of this really cool, rebellious kind of town where people just do what they want, not caring what anybody thinks about it, like Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis and Isaac Hayes and people like that. So it's
even looping back to the genesis and the creation of Stax Records is an anomaly in Memphis
at
that point in time.
Oh, Jim Stewart started Stax Records as Satellite Records to record country music. He liked what Sam Phillips was doing over at Sun Records with Johnny Cash and all these people, and he thought, well, you know, I can be a record producer too, so I'll just take my tape recorder to my aunt's garage and bring some bands over there and record them. And that's the way it started. And then he moved into where we are now in 1959 or 60 and to record country music. And then by chance, he met Rufus and Carla Thomas. They came over here and did a song. It became a hit. He fell in love with the music. He fell in love with the income because it was a lot more than what his bad country records were doing. And he was not a racist, just because back then so many people were. And he wasn't. And his sister, who invested in the company early on, wasn't. They didn't care.
And just as a reference, these are white people.
Yeah, the white brother and sister who did not care about color. They cared about music. They loved music. They welcomed anybody through this door who wanted to audition or could play, regardless. And this was one of the only integrated companies in the South. And it was not easy. It was easy inside Stax. It was not easy externally because I've heard stories that Stax artists tell me about a black and a white artist walking outside the building and standing on the sidewalk and having a policeman pull up and draw a gun on them, telling them to get back inside, that it wasn't happening.
Wow.
And when they first started, they couldn't eat at the same restaurants here. They couldn't drink out of the same water fountains, couldn't stay in any of the same hotels, so touring was difficult. And even if you look back, Booker T and the MGs, which was two black guys, two white guys, didn't have their photograph on an album cover until maybe their third, fourth album, because they were afraid nobody would buy it.
Very fascinating.
Yeah.
What were the first real big-time successes of Stax Records that put them on the map?
The first big-time success was a group of high school kids called the Marquees. And that was Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn, and they let Estelle Axton's son, Packy, join the group because they knew she had this recording studio over here, and some other kids, and they did a song called Last Night, and it was a dance song, and everybody fell in love with it, and it sold a million copies. They started traveling, going to American Bandstand. They had two versions of it. They had the recorded version, which was an integrated band, and the touring version, which was an all-white band, because that's the way they had to do it back then, because they couldn't.
That's painful.
Very painful. And believe me, there's still some feelings that are pretty raw today. But that song sold a million copies. Shortly thereafter, Gee Whiz by Carla Thomas sold a million copies. In 62, Green Onions by Booker T and the MGs. So what happened was when Last Night came out and became such a big hit, Jim Stewart and Estelle Axton found out there was already another Satellite Records. So that's how we got the name changed. They had to change the name, so they took the ST from Stewart and the AX from Axton and formed Stax Records, and
I wondered. I thought they were stacking up records.
Yeah, no. They used that pun a lot in logos and everything else.
Very fascinating.
But here they were. You know, Jim Stewart, he was a banker. He kept his day job until 1965. It just came over here at night. It was when one of the Otis Redding songs came out, and he thought, okay, I could quit my job at the bank now and do this full time. Mm-hmm. And they had a record store in what had been the candy counter of the, because this is an old
theater.
Old movie theater. Yeah. You know, we still have the slanted floor. And so what happened was Estelle decided to open a record store up front to make some extra money, but it also attracted neighborhood kids. And she used it as a marketing tool. She would put certain records on and watch the reaction of the kids, and if it real positive and they were dancing and they loved it, she would take it back to the studio and say, okay, this is what they love up front, so this is what y'all need to do, something like this.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah. She was great. She was the Lady A. She was the mother hen of the whole company.
Some more of the icons of Stax Records throughout the year 60s.
Oh, let's see. Otis Redding, Isaac Hayes, Eddie Floyd, Johnny Taylor, Rufus and Carla Thomas, the Staple Singers, Albert King, Sam and Dave, Hold On, I'm Coming, Soul Man, the Barkays with Soul Finger, and there was a lot.
And then something happened. There was a game shift after 69, 70. Things started going south for some reason.
Well, Stax basically has two periods. There's the period from beginning up to late 1967, early 1968, because in 1967, in a fine line deal with Atlantic Records, Stax lost every bit of its catalog. They had no product to sell.
What happened?
It was something in a contract that Jim Stewart didn't somehow, you know, he was a music maker, not a business executive. So Atlantic Records took all of the masters, all of the product. Stax was left with nothing. On December 10th of that year, Otis Redding and the Barkays were killed in a plane crash. He was 26 years old and their biggest star. Him and all these teenagers in his backing band all but one got killed, and that was a huge blow. And then when Martin Luther King was assassinated in April of 1968, that was another big blow to the world, and Stax Records just happened to be part of it.
It was like, part of it, ground zero. And
it was like Memphis's 9/11, you know, right. It was crazy. So
how far away is the Lorraine Motel?
It's about a five-minute drive from here. And ironically, that's where the Stax artists used to go hang out and eat lunch and swim and write songs, because everybody was welcome there. And that's where Martin Luther King ended up being assassinated. In fact, not a lot of people know this, but one of the artists on Stax was Mabel John, and she was in town recording, and she gave up her hotel room so that Martin Luther King could have the one that he wanted to stay in the front.
Wow.
I think she had to live with that for, you know, her whole life. So Al Bell came in. He said, all right, we're not going to go down. We're not going to go out of business. We're going to record 28 albums in 1 month. We're going to use every recording studio, every artist we can bring in here. It's going to be 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So they did it. They recorded 28 albums, and they had a giant sales conference and press conference and everything. And then it generated enough product and publicity to get Stax back on its feet. And then he started bringing in the Staple Singers and the Dramatics and some of those other big groups that are the whole second era of Stax, which includes Isaac Hayes as a performer, because he was just a songwriter until 1969. In 69, he broke out and went solo, and then really went huge in like the early 70s. Just, you know, he won the Academy Award for Shaft, and Hot Buttered Soul was one of the biggest selling albums of all time. So it did have a nice, prosperous second era, and then that's when basically the business community and a lot of other people thought that Al Bell had too much power and too much money, because Al Bell was black, and they basically set out to destroy him. And they did. They defaulted on a $1,900 loan was the final straw. And Al Bell pulled that money out of his pocket and said, I'll just pay this to you right now. I have it in my pocket. And they said, no, we're shutting this place down. We're padlocking it. You're out of business.
Sounds like the bank industry today.
Yeah. Only it's not so much out of racism like it was back then.
You know, they'll take anybody down.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, wow, how fascinating. So yeah. That was the end of Stax Records.
That was the end of Stax. Well, you know, they branched out. They lingered on for a little while longer. And Stax Records was kind of forgotten in Memphis, Tennessee, until we started this project here. All of a sudden, this new generation of people who didn't know about Stax and the old generation who did know about Stax were suddenly blown away by the story and the music and the just the magnitude that it had on Memphis.
Do you think because it was local and these were locals that people took it for granted and it took looking at it from a distant lens to appreciate it?
I think that people just forgot about Stax because it was a real painful ending. I think they still listened to and loved the music, but they didn't know the story. There were all sorts of rumors about what happened at Stax and all sorts of misperceptions and that kind of thing. But when we started building the museum, people from all over the world started just going crazy, thinking, finally, Memphis, Tennessee is going to put a shrine there where that record company used to be that was the most important record company in the world. So we started gaining the interest of not only people all over the world, but people in Memphis suddenly, especially in this neighborhood, became sort of proud to live here again. And now that they've seen what we've done and what we've done with the Stax Music Academy students who have traveled all over the world, what we've done with the Soulsville Charter School, where every single senior for 6 years has graduated and gone to college in a zip code that's one of the poorest in the country.
I was going to say, when you guys made the commitment to build the reincarnation of Stax, it was a sketchy neighborhood. And there was some.
It was sketchy is a nice word for it, because Stax had been demolished. Now, I was here the day that the original founders came over here to look around, and it was a freezing cold day in January, and we were on this empty lot, basically thinking we were going to get shot any minute. It was drug houses and broken glass, and where the Stax Music Academy stands right now, there was an abandoned apartment building, 65 units with no windows, full of garbage. There was garbage everywhere. There was a burned-up school bus on the lot. There was a refrigerator with no door. It was the worst scene of urban blight that anybody could imagine. And we all stood there thinking, okay, is this going to happen? Is anybody going to come to this museum? Thank goodness their vision was, we're going to build a museum, but we're not going to build a museum unless we build a school for these kids. because these kids in this neighborhood have absolutely nothing but to get in trouble or sit in front of a TV all day if they have one and drop out of school and get pregnant when they're teenagers and get hooked on drugs.
Tell us about the Academy of the school. That's a phenomenal success
story. The Academy is a great success story. The Academy started out in 2000 in a lunchroom of a nearby elementary school while everything here was under construction. It was basically little kids back then. Their first teacher was Rufus Thomas, which was really great. And it was more of we got to have a safe place for these kids to be. So all that kind of changed. We were serving 250 students every summer, young kids. And when the economy tanked in 2008, we had to rethink everything because we couldn't afford that. So we thought, we're going to serve fewer students, older students, and we're going to be the best music school in the world. And we're going to teach music theory and songwriting and marketing and engineering and real instruments, and real voices, all that. So we did that. We partnered with the Berklee College of Music in Boston. And since then, the kids have performed in Italy, Australia, Berlin, New York's Lincoln Center, Kennedy Center. They've opened for B.B. King. They played for Oprah Winfrey. In this summer, they are going on a tour to France, England, and Ireland to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the 1967 Stax tour. And we played for 3 days on the National Mall last year for the grand opening of the Smithsonian's new African American Museum, and the crowds were crazed. The kids are so talented. In 2005, we had this big empty building with kids coming after school and in the summertime. So we thought, well, we've got this beautiful big building. We can serve more kids. Let's do academics. We've got music down. So we started an academic college prep school, 66 graders. That now has the school has 650 students in it, 100% college acceptance rate among the 6 graduating classes we've had so far. A little over 300 seniors with over $50 million in scholarships and grants.
So basically every graduating kid goes on to college.
Yes, yes. And we have counselors who keep up with them in college until they graduate because 90% of them are first-generation college attendees.
And do you know how rare that is?
It's so rare that I have to pinch myself every day that I see that school because these kids would not, I mean, they're getting a free Eastern Seaboard boarding school, private school education. And they understand that, and they understand why we hold them to such high standards and why the discipline is so strict, and they appreciate that. They appreciate the fact that they are getting something that not a lot of kids are going to get.
And they wear uniforms, blazers.
Yeah, they wear blazers and neckties, and the girls have skirts and pants, and on certain days, if they've earned enough Grammy points for good behavior and good grades and all that sort of thing, they get to wear a college T-shirt, get to eat at lunch outside. There's a lot of carrot dangling.
Earned rewards.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Is this model being replicated?
People are looking at us, and I don't know that we're absolutely being replicated, but I do know that the Otis Redding Foundation is planning to open a charter school, and they are in serious talks with us.
And where is Otis Redding School?
That's in Macon, Georgia, where he was from. We have met with the principals at Motown. They're interested in doing some youth programming, and they came down to see us.
Motown and Detroit might do the same, similar models, what you're saying?
They might.
Possible.
Motown's getting ready to go through about a $50 million expansion, and I would hope that in Detroit, Michigan, if they're going to be doing that, they're going to be helping some kids too. I just hope everybody comes here and sees this place. It's the only soul music museum in the world. And
you know, we never finished the story about the neighborhood. So here it was, sketchy neighborhood.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So as time went forward, what happened?
Well, we invested a lot of money into 4 buildings on the original site of Stax Records on several acres. A local college development corporation built a development across the street that is now owned by a movie director who's getting ready to do some things with it. We never wanted to change the flavor of the neighborhood. We just wanted to revitalize it. So you'll see, I can drive around and see where I know there used to be abandoned homes and empty lots and burned up houses. I see new houses that have been built that look like they blend right in with the neighborhood. It's hard to even tell they're new. See people with cleaned up, painted front porches. We haven't gotten the business investment that we thought we would have by now, just for the neighborhood. But there are things like Memphis Slim, the bluesman who used to live next door, his house was caving in for years and years and years. And another organization got possession of it, and they took it apart, and they rebuilt it with the original materials as the Memphis Slim Collaboratory. It's a recording studio. It's a place for art exhibits and films and young musicians, old musicians. You can join for very little money and be able to record music there and rehearse there and stream live from there. And we partner with them on a lot of projects, and we do a lot of oral histories over there. It's just next door. So you'll see some really nice murals that have been done and things like that. But overall, it's still a very poor neighborhood.
For further information,
go to staxmuseum.com. Information about the Stax Music Academy, go to staxmusicacademy.org. And for information about our college prep school, go to SoulsvilleCharterSchool.org. And my name is Tim Sampson, and we are here at the site of Stax Records.
Tim, an absolute pleasure to spend the day with you.
Thank you so much. You too.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Memphis, Tennessee.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
Support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolff, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust preservation initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So yes, please support your local NPR station.